Our next speaker is Dr. Robert Fitzgibbons, who will be talking about infection, the Achilles heel of abdominal wall reconstruction. Dr. Fitzgibbons.
Okay, well, I'll continue my discussion about taking care of patients with complicated abdominal wall problems. Again, I have nothing relevant for this particular topic. Well, now, health-associated infections, or HALs, HALs are those infections that develop before the patient comes to the hospital, that we're not incubating before the patient comes to the hospital or develop in the hospital. That's the definition. 40 million persons hospitalized annually in the U.S., of which 5% or 2 million people will develop one of these. The morbidity and mortality is significant, 90,000 deaths and the sixth most common leading cause of death in the U.S. There's a variable prolongation of hospital stay, and it probably equates to $5 to $10 billion a year. Surgical site infections is up there high in this category. It's probably the second most common surgical site infection after urinary tract. Among the surgical patients, surgical site infections are the most common. About approximately 40% of all infections in surgical patients are related to the wound, of which 67% are confined to the incision, and the other third are deep infections, organ space infections. They add an average of about 7 days to each hospitalization, increase the hospital bill by about $10,000 in 2005 dollars. And the impact is really significant for surgical site infections. Over 3,000 deaths directly due to the infections in the U.S. according in 1993 data, and contributing to death in about 10,000 patients. So this is a significant problem we have to deal with. The incidence of wound infection, as I've already alluded to earlier, is much lower in the groin than it is in the abdominal wall, probably having to do with blood supply. But the groin appears to be a protected area. We do occasionally see infections, usually necrotizing infections when you do see one, and commonly related to another problem, such as a strangulated hernia with strangulated bowel, or an Ahmad's hernia with appendicitis in the hernia sac. And these can lead to necrotizing fasciitis. So that can be a problem, but that's pretty rare, fortunately. Now, ventral hernia, that's another situation. Ventral hernia's infection is high, varies in the literature from 0 to 23% in various series, but clearly much higher than in inguinal hernia. I chose this table because it looks at retromuscular repairs, which, as I mentioned earlier, is the gold standard operation. And you can see, although it's a good operation, the infection rate is high, with the infection rate in many of these series being greater than 10% for a retrorectus repair, which requires a rather extensive dissection. Now, on the other hand, laparoscopy has a very low infection rate, which is probably the biggest advantage of laparoscopy. You can see the column that's outlined there, where most of the infections are less than 4% in laparoscopic repair, and that's probably the number one advantage of laparoscopy over conventional herniorrhaphy repair. There's a trade-off, though, for that, because the incidence of serious visceral injury, commonly unrecognized, which results in a disaster for the patient, is much higher in laparoscopic repair. Now, this is one of the few randomized controlled trials in the literature comparing laparoscopic herniorrhaphy with incisional herniorrhaphy. It's by a respected investigator, Kamal Atani from Boston. I had the privilege of being chairman of the data review committee for this study. And we had to stop this study before it was completed, actually very much against my objections, because I thought it was a very important study. But the statistician stopped it primarily because of this huge difference in infection. Oops, sorry. That was being seen during the course of the study, 21% in the open group versus 2.8% in the laparoscopic group. But of course, you've got this little thing here too. You've got three bowel injuries in the laparoscopic group versus none in the open group. And if that was the reason why I pleaded with the statisticians to no avail, to let us continue with the study, because these injuries are life-threatening. These are a nuisance. So, but the statisticians told me that we could continue the study on until hell froze over, and the statistics weren't going to change because there was such a huge difference there. So suffice to say, the consensus opinion is that infection rate for open surgery is about 5 to 10% versus 0 to 3% for laparoscopic. And so we have this trade-off between wound complications and serious complications, which you can see with laparoscopy. Well, so infection truly is the Achilles heel of the abdominal wall reconstruction. You can do a beautiful job and then have an infection set in, and that just wrecks everything because recurrence is so high after infection. So the prevention of infectious complications is one of the most important measures of successful surgery. And increasingly, we were being looked at our infection rates. If you look at this study from the Journal of Healthcare Finance in 2008, looking at key performance issues that healthcare leaders feel that are important, you can see, if you look at the non-financial parameters that they felt to be important, you can see that one half of them were related to infection, hospital-acquired infection rates, surgical site infection rates, and infection control outcomes. So infection is a very important item that we have to deal with as surgeons. Definition of a surgical site infection. It's an infection of tissue or organs exposed to during an operative procedure. They're classified as incisional or organ-spaced. The incisional is divided into the superficial, which is in the subcutaneous tissue, versus deep, which involves fascia and muscle. The definition, the infection has to occur within 30 days unless you used an implant of some type, and then this extends out to 1 year. You have to have at least one of the following parameters to call this a surgical site infection. You have to have purulent drainage from the wound. You have, or at least one of the cardinal signs of infection, pain, localized swelling or tenderness, and redness. It's deliberately opened by the surgeon unless the culture that subsequently is obtained is negative. Organisms isolated from an aseptically obtained aspirate. An abscess determined by some type of radiological procedure, or documentation in the chart by the attending physician that there's an infection. That trumps everything. If there's any documentation by the attending or resident in a chart, that always trumps everything and is considered a surgical site infection. Imaging studies, sometimes it's difficult to differentiate it, infected fluid corrections. Collections from ordinary seromas in abdominal wall reconstruction because of the use of the prosthesis, and aspiration is commonly required. If you have gas, you have to be highly suspicious of an anaerobic infection or communication with an interabdominal organ due to perforation. Another unique problem to abdominal wall reconstruction is the ischemic or necrotic wound. You can see this patient. This patient, although obviously has an infection, and this is going to be classified as an infection, in reality, it's an ischemic wound because you can see the left side is completely normal. There's nothing wrong with that. All the business is on the right side because there's no blood supply here. So, do you call that an infection? Well, you have to because you can. Eventually, it's going to become secondarily infected, and they're going to culture organisms, but it's a problem of blood supply and probably is the reason why the infection rate is so high in abdominal wall reconstruction because of the large flaps that we create to mobilize muscle and skin results in ischemia to the tissue. That's one of the huge advantages of the posterior component separation, which I talked about in the last talk. You don't have to raise these large flaps with that operation. You don't have to mobilize the skin and subcutaneous tissue to the lateral edge of the rectus envelope because you're going to work below. And that's why I think it has so much potential for the future. Oops. Okay. Now, prosthetic infection itself, that's pretty hard to differentiate from a wound infection. Most of the series that deal with SSIs don't break that out. There's a lack of consensus of a definition for a prosthetic infection, and therefore the exact incidence really can't be calculated. We know, though, that there is a bimodal distribution. You have the early infections, which are usually superficial, and then the later infections, which are almost invariably involve the prosthesis and are deep. So risk factors for infection, patient-related risk factors, endogenous flora of the skin or mucous membrane, usually with anaerobic gram-positive cocci, and staphylococcus is the number one. Hollow viscus if there's an enterotomy with contamination with fecal flora. And then you have exogenous sources, surgical personnel, the operating room environment, instruments that are not properly cared for. And these are primarily gram-positive organisms and streptococcus. Preoperative issues related to infection, according to levels of evidence, we know that the method mechanism of hair removal, that is shaving versus clipping, is has been highly proven to be effective if we use clippers. And then identification of colonized surgical personnel. You're highly effective in decreasing infection rates. Questionable is antiseptic showering, and I'll get into that in a little bit. And unproven are the choice of skin preparation for both the patient and personnel, in other words, hand washing. Predictors of mesh infection, repair of a recurrent hernia. Recurrent hernias are associated with a higher rate of infection. History of smoking, operative time, body mass index, immunosuppression, steroids, coronary artery disease, and decreased serum albumin are all associated with increased infection rates. Patient risk factors and level of evidence. High nicotine and COPD are very high correlates with infection. Moderate is malnutrition and blood glucose levels. Questionable is diabetes and steroid use. And unproven is the use of mucopurine for nasal decontamination and perioperative transfusions. These are questionable. History of previous SSI has always been thought to be a strong risk factor, but in a fairly recent study by Rosen's group, they looked at their patient population, did not find any correlation, and did not think that should be considered a risk factor. Now, risk factors that are procedure-related, enterotomy, bowel resection, emergency procedures, prolonged operative time, perioperative blood transfusion, and the use of mesh to repair large ventral hernia defects greater than 10 centimeters. These are all interoperative factors that appear to have some relationship. The most questionable one is blood transfusion. Mesh-related. We talked about mesh in the last talk a little bit. Polypropylene is a middle of the road. EPTFE has high infection rates in certain series, but the big problem with EPTFE, if it does get infected, it invariably has to be removed. Now, polyester mesh in the United States, it's not used much because of this fear of a high infection rate of up to 16%, which has been reported. But in reality, I think that's an outlier, and I don't think there's really much difference between polypropylene and polyester. Now, people have attempted to develop risk scoring systems to try to predict infection rates so that they can take precautions. And this is just an example of one group. This group took 888 patients from their institution and analyzed data to come up with factors that appeared to be related to infection and then assigned them scores. And for example, mesh implantation didn't seem to correlate much with infection in their series, so they gave it a zero. A concomitant hernia repair, that is when the hernia repair was done in combination with another procedure, which was a risk factor and got a score of 2, large skin flaps 2, ASA 2, BMI 3, and wound class, if a class 4 wound, got 7 points. And you can see when you add these scores up that the infection rates become very high when you get into the 11 to 16 range of total points. These scoring systems haven't really been validated yet, but could be helpful for the future. Microbiology, Staphylococcus has gradually increased in its percentage of infection, and it really is the most important problem. You can see in this data, in the 1960s, it was about 17%, rose to about 20% in the 1990s, and the most recent data from the CDC shows about 30% of our SSIs are related to Staph aureus. And then coagulase-negative staph is present in about 14%. The others remain about the same, E. coli, enterococcus. But staph is the big player on the block. Now, proportion of SSIs caused by antimicrobial-resistant pathogens is increasing, and also Canna albicans. This may reflect the increasing number of severely ill patients we take care of, and also the fact that we have to take care of many immunosuppressed patients. Now, when you see outbreaks of clusters of SSIs with unusual organisms, this is invariably due to a break in technique in the operating room, contaminated personnel, or contaminated instruments. And so that usually can be stamped out fairly quickly. Classically, the dose of bacterial contamination times the virulence dictates the risk of surgical infection. But with abdominal wall reconstruction, we have to add in the foreign material, the extensive skin and subcutaneous tissue, which disrupts blood supply, and the fact that we have this problem with biofilm formation when we use prosthetics. So important factors are dose of bacteria, virulence, that is the amount of toxin produced by the organisms, and the resistance of the host. Now the biofilm, or the so-called polysaccharide slime, this is bacterial adherence to prosthetic material is required to produce infection, obviously. One mechanism of adherence is to create a microenvironment called a biofilm or polysaccharide slime. That's how the bacteria adhere to the prosthesis. And different constructs tend to be more resistant to biofilm, such as monofilament meshes are less a problem. These biofilm-dwelling bacteria behave differently than the free counterparts, the so-called planktonic bacteria, because they're being shielded by the coating, which protects them from antimicrobial therapy. A planktonic bacteria, which are the free bacteria, divide rapidly and are very susceptible to antibiotics agents for that reason. But the bacterial in the biofilm acts more like a dormant and therefore is not really that that sensitive to antibiotics, and it's hard to penetrate the biofilm, so that huge concentrations of antibiotics are required to have any effect. For treatment of these infections, antibiotics alone are sufficient for many, especially if there's just cellulitis. IND for fluxuants or any radiological evidence of any collection. We have to keep a close eye on the mesh to see if that's involved with the infection. Many times it isn't. It's just in the subcutaneous tissue, especially with the retrorectus repairs. If there's any confusion, we may have to aspirate the fluid around the mesh to determine this. If the mesh is determined to be infected, IND is the treatment of choice, because most of the meshes can be salvaged unless it's EPTFE. And, of course, if the patient is unstable, we have no choice but to remove the mesh, feeling this might be contributing to the sepsis. So proven strategies to decrease surgical site infections: minimize preoperative stay, identify and treat remote site infections, control glucose, address obesity, get the patient to quit smoking. And we tend, in our abdominal wall patients, we make them stop for 4 weeks, and we measure nicotine levels the week before to make sure they're doing it. Correct malnutrition, good physical conditioning, try to taper steroids. Preoperative showering, we'll say something about that in a minute. Appropriate hair removal, appropriate antisepsis for the surgical team, and we'll talk about that in a minute too, and then, of course, normothermia. Challenges in the prevention and management of surgical site infections. There's a changing population in hospitalized patient with increased severity of illness, increased number of surgical patients who are elderly. Many patients with chronic debilitating disease now come to surgery. There's growing frequency of resistant pathogens, and the lack of compliance with hand hygiene is a real problem with doctors in their busy practices. Now, let's talk about intervening at points of care to try to see what we can do about decreasing our surgical site infection rate. Postponing elective surgery in the case of a systemic remote infection, what is the evidence? CDC thinks it's very important and that we should be postponing surgery if there's any active infection, but there are no randomized controlled trials to really prove this. Mainly case reports and retrospective studies, primarily from joint replacement where there's felt to have been hematogenous spread. Probably not necessary to postpone for asymptomatic bacteriuria, or even a urinary tract infection, especially if an implant's not going to be used. Screening for MRSA, what's the value in that? Rationale is to detect and treat MRSA skin carriage before incision. It's empirically attractive, but all of the RSA randomized controlled trials are inconclusive, and so it remains controversial. Screening for nasal staphylococcal aureus. A study in cardiac surgery found that there was a higher incidence of SSI in Staph aureus nasal carriers than in non-carriers, and that's what sort of put this whole idea on the map. Subsequent studies with the use of intranasal mucurin did show a decreased incidence in Staph aureus infections, but did not affect the overall rate of SSIs. For general surgery, a large trial and a meta-analysis found no reason to use it, and nasal decontamination was not helpful. Antiseptics. We have to know something about antiseptics if we're going to try to lower our SSI rate. So the ideal antiseptic agent kills all bacteria, fungi, viruses, protozoa, tuberculosis, and spores. It's non-toxic, hypoallergenic, safe in all body regions, non-absorbable, has residual activity, and can be used repetitively. So what's available to us? Well, there are many, many formulations, but basically they all boil down to this. We've got 10% providone iodine, which is betadine, 0.7% iodophore with 74% alcohol, which is DuraPrep, 70% alcohol by itself, 4% chlorhexidine gluconate by itself, which is Hibiclens, and the combination of chlorhexidine and alcohol, which is ChloraPrep. So let's just look at these briefly. The iodine and the iodophores. Iodine is an effective agent against a wide range of bacteria. It penetrates cell walls and then oxidizes and substitutes the microbial contents with free iodine. Iodophores contain a surfactant stabilizing agent that liberates the free iodine. And so iodophore has largely replaced pure iodine as the active ingredients in antiseptics. The iodophores comprise free iodine molecules bound to a polymer, such as povidine, and that's why betadine is commonly referred to as povidine iodine. It's soluble in water and alcohol both, so it can be used as an aqueous scrub and paint solution. It can be used as a one-step position, just painting it, and it can be combined with alcohol, and that's what the preparation DuraPrep is. Alcohol on its own, it works by denaturing cell wall proteins in the bacteria. It's active against almost all organisms. Its concentration rather than the type of alcohol is what's most important. But the problem with alcohol is that it evaporates rapidly, so it is not has no persistence during the course of the procedure. Chlorhexidine, it can be an aqueous or alcoholic variety. It's again effective against the entire spectrum of organisms we need to kill. It's been shown to be highly effective in studies of hand washing, preoperative showering, and IV catheter care in decreasing bacterial count, not necessarily SSI. It has a lot of ideal characteristics. It's rapid onset. It's persistent. It stays around, unlike alcohol. It's not irritating. And it's been recommended in 15 evidence-based guidelines. Now, as far as the abdominal wall is concerned, this is a study of comparing betadine with 2% chlorhexidine with alcohol, chloroprep. And you can see that the, if you look at this graph here, you can see that the betadine is inferior to the alcohol CHG preparation in for both abdominal and inguinal hernias at all time points, early and then and delayed. So it, there's no question that probably the best antiseptic is the CHG alcohol one. Now, preoperative bathing and showering. Again, it's clear that the use of 4% chlorhexidine gluconate showers will decrease bacteria dramatically. And in the middle, as you can see in the middle graph for abdomen. But this has not really translated into proven decreased SSI rates. Nevertheless, the CDC recommends preoperative showering. And clearly, CHG is more effective than povidone iodine or just ordinary hand soap, medicated hand soap. This study by Garibaldi shows a reduction of bacterial contents 1.3-fold when they compared the two solutions. And the only really real study that shows a decreased infection rate is a study by Cruz and Ford in clean surgery, showing that a preoperative shower did decrease the infection rate, but it was not dramatic. Now, if one good is two better, well, this is a study which appeared to show that two showers, one the night before, one the day of, would decrease bacterial counts and subsequent SSI rates. So preoperative antiseptic skin care recommended by the CTT. Skin colonization is clearly decreased. However, the evidence that SSIs actually are decreased is very weak. And this can be emphasized by a Cochrane review, which included six trials with 10,000 participants, which found no evidence for the superiority of over a preoperative bathing to placebo. Hand antisepsis. Surgical hand scrubs should significantly reduce microorganisms on intact skin, contain a non-irritating antimicrobial preparation, have broad-spectrum activity, and be fast-acting and persistent. The alcohols are good, but they do not have persistence, and that's that can be a little bit of a problem for them. They also can be potentially drying. The iodophores, they have a good spectrum for killing bacteria in the skin. They have some persistence, but they can be irritating to skin. The chlorhexidine, again, is probably the best. The only caveat with the chlorhexidine is that you have to be careful if you're going to use it around eyes and ears or nerve tissue. It can be damaging to those structures. Combined agents, we've sort of talked about already. The combined agents appear to have the most efficacy. So summary for surgical hand antisepsis, formulations containing 60 to 90% alcohol alone or 50 to 90% when combined with CDG, lower bacterial counts on skin post-scrub, more effective than other agents. The next most active agents in their order are the iodophores and then plain soap. Antibiotic prophylaxis. The key here is we must balance society's needs for cost and decreased bacterial resistance versus decreasing the infection rate. Systemic reviews and meta-analysis of the effectiveness of antibiotics have not really shown that antibiotic prophylaxis is helpful in abdominal wall reconstruction. There's only really two relevant trials for umbilical incisional. There's more for abdominal wall mesh, and the only thing that can be told from these trials is what we already know, that infection rates are much higher with abdominal wall reconstruction than inguinal, but there's insufficient data to draw a conclusion about the value of prophylaxis. So the conclusion is that in the absence of objective data, antibiotics are the standard of care for large wounds. If extensive dissections are going to be anticipated, if there's a likelihood of interabdominal injury, if there's a likelihood of seroma or hematoma, and if there's a need for surgical drains. Operative skin preparation. Do not shave here. unless it will interfere with the operation. If we shave it, I mean, if it has to be removed, electric clippers, then wash and clean. This is the study that sort of put this on the map, showing a much lower infection rate with no shave and clipping, and the worst was with when razors were used. This is a study from the New England Journal of Medicine, which is often quoted, talking about chlorhexidine alcohol versus betadine for surgical site antisepsis. This study was in clean and clean contaminated wounds, and the premise of the study was that the skin is a source of infection associated with surgery, and it was a multi-center randomized trial in clean contaminated patients, and the results was that preoperative application of chlorhexidine was the most effective agent. And this is just a graph from that study. This is a Cochrane analysis of preoperative antiseptic for preventing surgical wound infection, 13 studies involving 2,600 participants. Many different products were evaluated, which made the data a little bit difficult to interpret, but clearly 4% chlorhexidine scrub and 70% alcohol was the best. The only problem with chlorhexidine is it's more expensive than betadine. But other than that, it's clearly the choice of antiseptics. So we're almost done here. Surgical technique also is important in surgical site infection. We have to learn to handle distal gently, maintain hemostasis, minimize devitalized tissue, minimize foreign body, eradicate dead space, and active surveillance and feedback to surgeons is critical important to decreasing infection rates. We know that if feedback is provided, surgeons will tend to take steps to try to keep their infection rates low. Leave wound open for in face of heavy contamination. And if you're going to use surgical drains, closed suction drains are the best. Do not bring them out through the wound and remove them as soon as possible. Interoperative considerations, surgical gowns and drapes that are effective barriers when wet. Change your surgical scrubs if they become soiled. Avoid hypothermia, avoid hyperglycemia. Surgical drains, there's insufficient evidence in a Cochrane analysis to determine whether wound drains after incisional hernia repair are associated with better or worse outcomes. Predictors of mesh explantation after incisional hernia. The only significant factor is when we're performing these incisional hernias as a concomitant procedure to another procedure. For example, maybe you're doing a colectomy and then you repair the hernia. This appears to be the most significant risk factor for mesh explantation. Now, I'll end just with a couple of items that have been tried to help us to decrease our infection rates. Supplemental O2, the rationale is that increasing partial pressure in surgical wounds enhances the oxidative killing of leukocytes. Once perfusion is assured, addition of increased oxygen substantially reduces surgical site infection. There's been several trials to show that, but it remains debatable. We tend to use 5 liters of oxygen in all of our abdominal wall reconstructions and have an order not to titrate until the patient goes home. Strategies with limited data to say if they're any good, double gloving or glove changing. A Cochrane review of 26 controlled trials was inconclusive. Use of adhesive drapes, use of iodine impregnated occlusive skin barriers, ear and neck caps, laminar flow, and suture versus staples. None of these have enough data to make any strong conclusions of whether they actually work. So in conclusion, surgical site infection result in significant patient morbidity and mortality and increased hospital costs for abdominal reconstruction. Reduction in the incidence can be achieved by strict adherence to standard surgical guidelines. Observations have revealed failure to follow standard guidelines is a significant cause of surgical site infection. And strict adherence to standard guidelines are important. And that's especially true now because of this concept of bundling, which you've heard about today, where many of these strategies that perhaps don't have hardcore evidence that they work are bundled together and strictly adhered to, and there appears to be much better results with these bundles. So with that, I'll stop, and I appreciate the privilege of the floor.